Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, we're going to talk about a timely subject. We're going to talk about the future of work and how it correlates to agriculture and food. All right, so first, we got a few jaw-dropping stats. According to the UN's FAO estimates, there are 1.2 billion folks employed in global agriculture. And depending where you live, the disparity of employment in food production versus other subjects is vast. And so to give you some context to that, in Thailand, 32% of the population is employed in agriculture. In Pakistan, 42% work for our food. In Uganda, 71% of the population. And here in the U.S., 0.7%, not even 1% of our employment, of folks who are working, are involved in agriculture, fisheries, and forestry. We threw in a couple other subjects, actually, a couple sectors of fisheries and forestry. 0.7%. Now, mind you, this is the same United States who has turned how we feed ourselves into a bit of a house of cards, where we spend the lowest percentage of our discretionary income on what sustains us, which is 5 to 6% of that discretionary income, on our food, and the highest percentage on reactionary healthcare of 18% of our total GDP of all the developed world. So quite a paradox here. And it really doesn't matter that we're the richest country in the world when we still have 40 million Americans who go to bed hungry every night in this modern food system. So we need to become more connected with our food and health and through creating jobs and economic stimulus via proper shepherding of the land and its bounty of inherited natural resources. Obviously a focus that we have here on Sourcing Matters. But do we need to revert back to Jeffersonian lifestyle or times? Well, I don't know, and probably not, because that cat is already out of the bag. But maybe we need some more balance, and maybe we need some perspective that will do some good for all of us. So on the flip side, we go and look at global small stakeholder farmers in some of the aforementioned countries, which face what seems to be insurmountable problems. Perpetual loops of attaining funds to pay for seeds and inputs from the same folks who are buying their crops and control that very supply chain that they're selling into. Never mind the changing climate and increasingly reduced access to needed regenerative natural resources like fresh water and good soils. So often those small stakeholder farmers are really held over the barrel by these folks with the vested stake for the farmer to deliver. So the cost of capital for these farmers can reach an outlandish rates that small stakeholder farmers can never claw themselves out of a bad situation. In the developed world, it's big banks and seed companies who really own the pipeline. But in the developing world, it's loan sharks. Today, we welcome a guest doing something about this issue. Today, we welcome Usman Javed. He's the CEO of Recolt, which is a startup that spawned out of MIT to change the paradigm in global agriculture by rejiggering how folks who grow food in all corners of the world can access resources and later sell their crops to benefit themselves and their consumers and not the land sharks. Usman, how are you today?
Thank you so much, Aaron. I'm great. And thank you for having me on your show.
Of course. How's the summer going?
Great. Hot. But as long as you're busy and as long as you keep yourself fit, it's not that bad.
Yeah. You know, the humidity, it's been a thick summer, especially August, right?
True that.
And you do travel all over the world.
Yes.
You come from Pakistan.
Yes.
And so if you're saying this about Boston, Massachusetts, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, I feel a little better that I'm not the only, like, I'm so used to the cold northern weather that that I'm out of whack. But it has been a bit of a tougher or out of normal summer. Maybe our new normal for summers.
Maybe climate change is real.
I've heard that. Yeah, I think maybe we can look into that. So Usman, let's get into what you're seeking to accomplish, what you've been able to do, and where your goals are. So you are working on a solution to global problems like food shortages and malnourishment and poverty and rural unemployment. And you need to start with the small stakeholder farmers and from the context. And I think that's really your defined mechanism. That's where you seem to be your differentiation. The world is ready for, as you state, the world is ready for a farmer to be revolutionized and become more inclusive and empowering for the very people who are the backbone of the industry. So the farmers themselves. And your promise, you give small stakeholders, this is through your company Recold, you give small stakeholder farmers the tools that they need to better inform and empower economic actors and to work their way out of poverty. So if you could you share with our audience what you seek to accomplish with Recold and why what you're doing matters so much?
Yeah, no. So just to throw in some stats, by 2050, the world will need at least 50% more food than it has today. And this is not a small problem. It's a problem with colossal impact. And it's not something which you can just fix overnight. Now, if you look at the food production landscape, about 600 million farmholds exist in the world, and 87% of them are smallholder farmers, which gives you the extent of the problem. Now, just by definition, because these smallholder farmers are small, they're denied the economies of scale that large farmers have, which reduces their bargaining power with the actors within the value chain. And it severely inhibits their ability to access basic things which you would take for granted in more developed countries like the US or Europe. And that's exactly the problem that we're trying to address. Recult, as the name suggests, is the middle world of agriculture. So we cannot exist without agriculture literally and metaphorically. What we're trying to build is, and to some extent we have built that as well, is an integrated digital platform that addresses all the needs of the farmer, but in a very transparent way so that everyone wins in this equation. We are a for-profit. We're not a non-profit. And the reason why we are for-profit is because I believe that non-profits are dependent on donations, and donations are not sustainable. So you need to give everyone an incentive to win. And that's exactly what we're trying to do.
I do agree. I mean, I think the philanthropic world can be an excellent Kickstarter. But using that as a mechanism to then create revenue, which effectively you're servicing individuals who are doing it for a for-profit entity anyhow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So providing them those resources and making that a connection point, I think, is essential for sustaining over a long
yeah.
horizon.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about where you started your initial proof of concept and some of the buy-in you've had. From what I've read on the site, and we've talked about this in the past in our meetings, you state that Recult aims to fix agriculture value chain through mobile platform. By improving the value chain, we are enabling farmers to put themselves out of poverty while tapping a multi-billion-dollar market. And you've launched pilot programs in Pakistan in February of 2016, and you currently service over 3,600 farmers accessing your platform. So how did you go about starting this and capturing those 3,600 farmers? Maybe that's an old stat. Maybe you have more than that at this point. And obviously dealing with the adoption from many of the small stakeholder farmers, is there a technology concern there? Do they have the technology you need to scale out the platform to make this transformative change?
Yeah. So I'll answer your second question first. There's a huge misconception that unless farmers have a smartphone, you can't service them with the latest tools that are available. Another misconception is that farmers are not tech savvy. They don't know how to use technology. And I was involved in the launch of Easy Paisa, which is the world's third largest mobile banking business now, which operates on dumb phones. This is very similar to M-Pesa, which is very popular in Africa. And when we were launching that business, and because it was targeted towards the unbanked, people who don't have a bank account, we got the same concerns that these people don't know how to operate a mobile phone. It's just gonna flop. But the billions of transactions that happen every month now, just through a dumb phone. So our focus is not more so in terms of developing an app which can work on a smartphone, but developing a system and more so an ecosystem which can integrate all sections of the society, regardless of whether these people are smartphone enabled or dumb phone enabled, as long as they have a piece of land and they're willing to farm, they can benefit from our services. And what we've developed is a model which, if the farmer has a smartphone, he can download the app. If the farmer has a dumb phone, we have a model based on IVRs and outbound voice calls and SMS. If the farmer doesn't have a phone, we are enabling current actors within the ecosystem with smartphones who can then distribute that information directly to the farmer. So I believe it's more of an information play, and the ability to distribute that information is something which exists and something which a lot of companies just shy away from because it's probably, I guess, more grunt work. But I mean, I can tell you for sure, if you go to developing countries, barring a few countries which have just leapfrogged from no phones to smartphones like Myanmar, the bulk of phone usage is dumb phones. And if you're building a solution for people who are at the bottom of the pyramid, you can't just build a solution which is targeted to a segment which only has smartphones. So from that point of view, I don't think technology at all is a limiting factor. The technology is available out there. The technology has worked in the past, and I see no reason why it shouldn't work in the future. Coming back to your first question in terms of adoption and how did we go about getting these farmers and what is the status of our pilot? So we started off initially in Pakistan, thinking that we'll create an online marketplace for farmers to buy seeds, fertilizers, and inputs. What we realized very soon was that 95% of all transactions happen on credit. And unless we solve the credit problem, we'll not be able to get people to buy inputs from us, or we keep on working with the 5% who were buying on cash. So that is when we started working on our credit module, and we built our own credit scoring model, which uses a lot of informal data sets to work out the credit score. And then we partnered with a company in the US to create a fund where we then channeling the fund, the investment in the fund to the farmers, and we get a certain return, which is then also shared with the investors who invest in the fund. Once we started getting into the credit piece, we realized that there are two kinds of farmers primarily, or you could actually segment farmers on two basic axes. One is farmers who don't have the ability to pay back, but then there are also farmers who don't have the willingness to pay back. And we can work with farmers who don't have the ability to pay back, but we can't work with people who don't have the willingness to pay back. And once we realize that there are lots of people out there who have the willingness to pay but don't have the ability, that took us a step further into using data and information to help those farmers improve their ability to pay back. And that is where the improvement in the credit score comes in. So not only do we identify people who don't have access to credit, but we also help them improve their credit worthiness throughout the cycle. And once we realize that we need to provide this information so that we could improve their credit worthiness, if the farmer doesn't get a good price for his harvest, at the end of the day, you're still back to square one. One of the biggest problems in developing countries is that we operate in very inefficient markets. And when I say inefficient markets, it means that there are lots of intermediaries between the buyer and the seller. And each intermediary takes a certain commission on every transaction that he conducts, which actually lowers the price that the farmer can sell for. And the gains go directly to those middlemen. So what we realized was that if we can help the farmer access inputs, if we can get him credit, if we can improve his yield, but in the end, if he can't get a good price for his harvest, all that hard work comes down to zero. And that is when we then started working on our output platform, and we built a model which connects farmers directly to end buyers like processing mills, so that they get a better price, and at the same time, there's transparency in the whole system. So this is how the end-to-end model actually works.
I think you clearly stated that the requirement for a clearinghouse, the requirement for a funding partner, the requirement for a bimodal supply chain was needed. You had to redefine the whole stack.
And
you took it as a systems problem.
Yeah.
And by doing it as a modern innovation realm using technology, whether that's smartphone or dumb phone, which I'm guessing is SMS technology. It allowed you to then probably engage more with those farmers and providing it as a resource. Did you get the buyers first or the producers and suppliers first?
So since we'd been working with the farmers, we had the farmers first. And then once we had the yield, we were able to connect with the buyers.
So when we first met a few years ago, I met with some of you and your team. I always remember looking at this and saying, you know, your founding team and some of the folks that you've brought together via, I think, Sloan School at MIT. Yeah. It was like I was so impressed. It was like a kind of a mini UN fighting for a better agro system.
That is true. It was exciting
to look at that. So how did you all connect around this? How did you find that there was commonality in Thailand and Pakistan and other developing worlds in the agricultural side, or really the groups that had these same problems? It doesn't have to be developing world. This stack needs to be defined for many groups, small stakeholder requirements. How did you know that you had that shared mission, and how did you go about starting to look at this while you're in the kind of confines of Cambridge, Massachusetts?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess MIT has a lot to do with this, and apart from a lot of other benefits, one of the biggest benefits MIT provides is access to a lot of different people. I met Okrit, who's our co-founder, and he manages the operations in Thailand, in a class. And it's interesting that we both presented an idea which was pretty similar. And I approached him to see if he's willing to join hands, and that's exactly what happened. And then our CTO, I remember I sent out an email to the computer science course that this is what we're trying to do, and if you're interested in changing the world. And it's interesting that a couple of people responded, and these are people who are in high demand. It's not that they weren't able to find a job. And our CTO, really proud of him, he's an undergrad and a master's from MIT, from the computer science school, which is one of the best in this space. And he had job offers from a lot of other companies, but he preferred to stay with us and work on a problem which affects the whole world. So, and then our fourth co-founder, Gabe, again, we got to know him through the Modern Trust Center at MIT. He's also an undergrad in physics and economics. MIT is a great seeding place for connecting with people.
It's I think to your testament day, it's a tough value proposition when you're going into someone with the kind of credibility of your tech co-founder and saying, I can pay you nothing, I can give you no benefits, but we can change the world together, right?
Exactly.
And
exactly.
You have to be, that conviction comes across, right? The only way, you can't fake that authenticity when you're making that kind of pitch to someone that has the ability to work for whoever they want.
Yeah. I mean, one of the, and this is the way I look at it, that the biggest, that one of the most important role that, an entrepreneur plays is the role of a storyteller. He needs to create a story which connects with people, and he needs to tell that story to people, because startups don't have money, but they have dreams and hopes and promises of fame and promises of salvation and whatever you want to call it. And there are people out there who are smart and who feel that they should be giving back to the community. So I was very lucky in that respect that we were able to find such people.
Yeah. And I mean, I obviously being able to be selected and brought into MIT, it does shorten the pool to reduce serendipity, maybe to increase serendipity. I don't know, however you look at it, but here's an opportunity to work with a bunch of very smart people that all have the street cred and the experience to do these type of things. So let's talk a little bit about your bio and what, you know, nice short bio that I read about you here, and we've had chats, but I'll leave it nice and short. You tell us more. So you have 15 years of experience in telecom, mobile banking, as you mentioned, and then mobile agriculture in Pakistan and Bangladesh, and now an MBA from MIT. But so tell us a bit more about how that background melded into this passion for fixing this infrastructure problem within global agriculture and food.
Yeah, I started off my career actually with Exxon in Pakistan. They used to sell fertilizers at that time. I was in sales. My job was to sell fertilizers. And I got a firsthand view of how difficult the lives are for farmers in Pakistan. And my job was literally to spend time with the farmers. So I had a very good idea of what's going on. And then when I quit Exxon, or Engro now as it is called, I moved to Nestle. And there I had a very good view of dairy farmers. And I realized that how the system literally has brought them to a verge of collapse. I mean, just to throw in some stats, there are about almost 100,000 farms in Pakistan who are stuck in bonded labor for loans or debts that their forefathers took. And the farmers are paying it off now. And this will continue for generations, because the system is designed to keep the farmer in a state of dependency. I mean, a few years ago, I remember in India, a couple of farmers set themselves on fire in front of the Prime Minister of India to protest that they did not have the funds to pay back their loans. And in this case, the loans were provided by the microfinance banks. So unfortunately, the whole system is designed to suppress this community for their own gains. And it's one of the toughest problems to solve, because there's just so many moving pieces to this. And there's so many vested interests. And it's such a deep-rooted issue that no one individual can just come in and say, solve the problem. But where I feel maybe the tech world has not been able to do a good job is in coming up with solutions that are targeted towards solving these problems. You'll see every entrepreneur that comes out wants to be another Facebook or another Google. You'll rarely see people who want to roll up their sleeves and get into a field with a farmer to understand what his problems are. It's not glamorous. It's not something which will give you a $1 billion valuation immediately. So, you know, unfortunately, the whole system is designed, maybe intentionally or unintentionally, to not support this large segment. And then the very fact that this is a problem of the developing world, it's not a problem of the developed world, makes it even more complicated. Fundraising is an issue. Getting technology at the right price point is an issue. Getting resources is an issue. So it's not easy even for people who actually want to go out and try and solve this problem. I mean, we just closed a $1.8 million pre-Series A round in June, but I know how difficult it was to convince investors to invest in this. So unfortunately, because the whole ecosystem is geared towards probably maintaining status quo, it makes the problem even more difficult.
You worked for multinational billion-dollar organizations, yeah. ExxonMobil, you worked for Nestle, you come out of an MBA from one of the most prestigious universities in the world. And you could have gone anywhere, but I get the idea that you took the entrepreneurial stage, but what was the, again, I'm going to revert back to this question and say, what was the impetus for you? I mean, so you could have gone anywhere and taken this, but what's the fire in your belly that said enough's enough? Was it the time and looking at these people and realizing that you're just empathetic to them, or was it something that you changed?
So just to continue that answer. So after Nestle, I joined Telenor. Telenor is a Norwegian telecom company which has a very strong footprint in Asia. And there, when we launched EasyPesa, which was the mobile banking business, I realized how basic, simple technology could be used to create huge social impact. And I always wanted to do something for the farmers, but then when I realized that actually technology could be a solution, that's when I started to experiment and see what could be done. And I reached a stage where I said that I've had enough. It's about time that I actually take the plunge and see what I can do about this. And that's exactly the reason why I came to MIT, primarily because it's a great platform for people like myself who are not part of the local ecosystem to get resources and the relevant access.
Fast forward a couple of years here now, and so in the last couple of years, you've gained some pretty unique supporters, some huge household names, folks like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the UN Industrial Development Organization, the Martin Trust Center for MIT Entrepreneurship, the Global Social Venture Competition, just to name a few that you've had backing from. Well, I mean, that's going to feel pretty good, right? I mean, that not only is a nice confirmation that you're doing something special here, but it does open your horizons to have access points that are making these decisions. And maybe that is a foot in the door to raise that $1.8 million funding round you needed. But I'm guessing there's even a further horizon that you're looking at here of, if you're really going to make this transformative change in global agriculture and working with some of those, maybe those big brands you spawned out of, how do you then work with those organizations that have said, you know, that Usman, I like what he's doing, let's see what we can do. How do you work with them to continue Recult down this next step, down this path of transformative change?
Yeah. So all of these have been great supporters. The Gates Foundation, particularly, they gave us a grant. They support us whenever we need them. They've also been encouraging us to move into other markets. So we're constantly in touch with them. Similarly, the UN, they have a lot of funds, but they're not very clear as to how they want to move forward with that. But then definitely it opens up a lot of avenues for us. So the way I see these organizations primarily is that it gives you a huge seal of credibility. Even if they don't give you any funding, even if they don't give you any resources, just the fact that they endorse what you're doing in itself is a huge step forward in many ways, because it opens up a lot of doors. It helps us deal with investors. It helps us deal with other partners in the ecosystem. And I think that's the biggest support we can get at this stage.
Yeah, and it allows to, I mean, it's funny because, you know, this is not a process that is a 9-to-5 job. It's all, and I'm sure because I live it too, right? You have days where you're flying on top of the world, and then the same, like within a couple hours, you're down at the bottom, like, what am I doing?
It's
the perils of that entrepreneurial mindset.
Exactly.
So what do you, as an international coming into the States and coming with this background, but sure, you have the same struggles as any entrepreneur does. What suggestions would you have as we're both entrepreneurs over 40 years old, as we were joking about our cholesterol levels and talking about breakfast, what recommendations would you give to our listening audience that are seeking advice to get involved in this future food system?
Stay focused and just keep on knocking on every door you can get your hands on. A lot of times at that point in time, you might find that meeting that guy or going to that event is not useful, but believe you me, I have actually benefited way more from people I thought would never benefit me than the other way around. So never close a door, stay focused. I think, and I was going through this TED talk the other day with this child psychologist, and it's an interesting story, not a story, but actually a research where this child psychologist did a research on why do some people fail and why do some people succeed in life. And she did thousands of interviews with people in the military academy, with people in banks, etc., etc. And the one thing she narrowed it down to was grit. Having the ability to stand up every time you fall down. And to me, entrepreneurship is not for the faint-hearted. It's not for for people who cannot give it their everything. It's literally, you have to consistently fall down, have to consistently fall and get back up. And as you just said, I mean, I generally tell a lot of people who come and get my advice, the entrepreneurship is a roller coaster of emotions. One day you're on top of the world, the other day you're at the bottom of the pit, and literally you're about to cry. So I have cried, I've been happy, there've been tears of joy, there've been tears of grief, but that is the nature of the beast. So just be consistent, focused, have the strength to stand back up. If you don't have that, then entrepreneurship is not for you.
Get up, dust yourself off, right? Do it
again.
Grab that bat and do it again.
Yes, yes.
And you know, you do get better.
Yes,
You learn. Yes, and it is not for the faint of heart. But you know, I think you develop that capacity, and to that point, boy, if you don't love it, I don't think it's the right place, right? You've got to have something you really care about.
Yes.
Don't waste your time.
Exactly. I mean, it all boils down to how badly do you want it.
Yeah.
If you really want to change the world, changing the world is not easy.
Yeah.
If you expect that you can just go out there, make one app, and the whole world will change, that's not how worlds change.
Yeah. So I drone on often about the perils and the problems and the disparity and the craziness in D.C., but recently, you applied to become a permanent part of the workforce here in the U.S. via a Colt and an I-140. Share with our audience too, if you would, about that. Of that, you know, despite all the problems we're talking about in the States, and it's easy to look back and you know point a finger, but we got some good things going on here, right? We have something that you want to be a permanent part of, so. Maybe if you could share your desire to use your unique skills, your intellect, your capacity to do great good in the domestic U.S. So, you know, you're spending a lot of time here, you're working on this, and this is the place you want to set up camp. Why is that?
Yeah, so the primary reason is that the U.S. is way more advanced and way ahead of any other place in the world when it comes to technology. When it comes to access to resources. And one of the biggest reasons why I feel we need to set up camp here is just because of that. It has tremendous resources in terms of intellectual capital, in terms of financial resources, in terms of R&D. And if you are going to try and change the world, you need access to these resources. There is no other way you can do it. I cannot live in an area where there are no resources and then try and change everything around me. It just doesn't happen, unfortunately. So that is one part of it. Then the other part I feel, which is again something where I can play a big role in, is the domestic agriculture. The system that we're building is not just limited to farmers in developing worlds. There is a huge segment of farmers here who also suffer from the same kind of exploitation that farmers in the developing world suffer. So that, again, motivates me that if I can be a part of this system and not only help people or farmers outside of the U.S., but also in the U.S., I think that'd be a great step forward for me and for Recult and for the tech space that I am in.
Usman, where can we learn more about Recult and yourself? What do you have a website that our audience can listen to and read more about?
We have a website called www.recult.com. We have a Facebook page by the name of Recult. So these are the two best places to read up on us. We have a couple of major events coming up in our company. We've partnered with a large telecom company in Thailand, and we have a major launch coming up on the 6th of September. So we are very hopeful that once that takes place, it'll definitely allow us to provide our tools to 100,000 farmers at least very soon.
Fantastic. And we do have listeners in Pakistan. We have listeners in India. We have listeners in Kashmir. If they are farmers themselves or if they're dealing with farmers, can they also get information on where they can partake in this rollout to that 100,000 farmers?
Yeah, the best way to get in touch with us is Facebook. A lot of people leave messages there and we respond within 24 hours. So if anyone has any questions, they want to learn more about us, please feel free to get in touch with us.
So as we look at this, and Recult is trying to disrupt an age-old and archaic and antiquated agricultural system affecting the farmers, mostly themselves, I look at this as an interesting discussion. As you mentioned, we've got 50% more people to feed by 2050. And if we look at the future of work and reverting back to where we're going to be looking, this is a jobs creation opportunity. And if we can engage those farmers to get more benefit out of this program by having a better presence, a better understanding, and maybe more provenance and integrity within that supply of getting their products to market, well, that's an exciting thing. And it is a systems and ecosystem solution. And whether you're looking at solving that credit problem through dumb phones or on-ramping more farmers there, that's an exciting iteration that as technology continues to progress and continues to envelop the world, there's more opportunity for more people to be engaged in your platform and sourcing food with that integrity and that provenance. And I couldn't agree more that the dependency system, whether it's the developed or the developing world, and of this extractive approach towards agriculture is the thing that it will drastically change. And it won't wait till 2050. This is going to be in the next decade. This will be in our lifetimes when we're directly with our hands affixed to the wheel trying to solve these problems. And the fact that you've been able to work with that group that provide you that seal of credibility is to your credit and to your team's credit. So congratulations, and I look forward to continue to see how things progress.
Thank you so much, Aaron, and thank you for the opportunity and getting me here, and pleasure talking to you, as always.
As always, and I'll just say until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.